Okie dokie. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast with yours truly, myself, Simone. And today is a first for the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast. We have our first guest that's all caps, bold, and italicized. We have a registered dietitian with us today. I'm so excited. I have a really good longtime friend of mine that I met in graduate school, Tracy Rupp, with us that specializes in kidney health. So I think this can be very, like, selfishly, I'm just gonna say this. I am gonna, if nobody else learns anything, I will. So this might be episode, maybe it's just for me, who knows? But one thing I did run into while navigating the Nutcracker space is that when trying to find a registered dietitian to help address Nutcracker syndrome specifically, and then just vascular compressions in general, I really couldn't find a registered dietitian that specialized in the specific vascular space. Like, they could, like, indirectly speak toward it. But Tracy, like I told you, Nutcracker syndrome and vascular compressions in the medical world, is there's so little that's known about it. Just so I have to go to most of my doctors and educate them on what it is. So of course, in the, like, registered dietitian space, it's probably not this centralized thing. So but with you having your we'll discuss obviously the ins and outs of kidney health. I know you've done some research on Nutcracker, like, to prepare, so I'm so excited about that. Thank you for doing that. So we won't necessarily specifically, I want to set the audience up that we won't specifically be like, okay, you have Nutcracker syndrome, this is what you need to do from a registered dietitian, nutrition, meal plan space. We're going to talk about overarching things, talk about some taboo topics as well. So I really, really think what we're going to chat about today will bring a lot of benefit to the audience, to myself, and maybe even just, like, start the journey of expanding vascular compressions into the nutrition space, registered dietitian space. So basically, today I really want us to get into how can we mitigate the impacts of that Nutcracker has on our bodies, especially for those that are waiting to have surgery or those who have had surgery and need to show your kidneys a little extra love from the absolute onslaught of trauma that we have endured on this process. I know my kidneys are still, I mean, I wouldn't say they're damaged, but they're sad. They're sad. They really are. I
They're
know they
crying a
are.
little
Yeah, they're crying a little bit. So, anyways, without further ado,
bit.
Tracy, I would love for you to take some time to introduce yourself, tell us who you are, what your qualifications are, and how you came to love kidneys as a dietitian.
Yeah. So I super appreciate that you have me on here. And again, we definitely don't get specific training in the nutrition world on Nutcracker syndrome. I had never actually heard of it until you started posting about your journey, Simone. So it was super interesting to kind of read on it. But I've been a dietitian since 2019. Right now, I only have a license to practice in the state of Tennessee, but I do serve other states as well, just kind of depending on their rules and regulations around that. I've had some experience in the clinical nutrition setting. I worked in the hospital setting for about a year and a half before doing what I do now, which is dialysis. And I love dialysis. I fell in love with it when I was a student. We do a dietetic internship, and I'll kind of go into that a little bit later as well. But I remember my dialysis rotation and just falling in love with the field and learning how much the kidneys actually do for us, which is a lot. There's a lot more than people think. So that's why I became so interested in it. I'm a board certified specialist in kidney nutrition as well. And more recently, I have opened up a private practice. So I do that along with my dialysis job right now. But that's not just for kidneys. I serve anybody that's interested in nutrition to better, help with their own, if they're having chronic illnesses or just want to feel better. I serve that community as well. It's not just the kidney community.
Yeah, in a little context, Tracy and I's relationship goes far back to grad school. We met, you were the triathlon club president, and I wanted friends and also to overexercise because that was my that was my coping mechanism. So we became friends there. So you have that background also athletically, like being an endurance athlete. You were a swimmer for a lot of your life. So I remember that you introduced me a lot to, like, the fueling aspect of athletics, so I indirectly. So I wanted to expand upon your lived experience of just not in the kidney world, but that being an athlete yourself, looking at nutrition as a fuel. So it's really been a part of your narrative for a lot longer than just since 2019.
Yeah, totally. I grew up with very athletic parents as well. My dad is a, triathlete. He's done Ironman. My mom's a personal trainer. So I've always kind of grown up being in the more athletic space and kind of finding nutrition and fueling your body to be very fascinating because there's a very, direct correlation of, oh, this run was horrible. Why do I feel like I've never run before? Oh, I didn't eat today. You know what I mean? And so it was just kind of fascinating to learn throughout, schooling, but from personal experience as well, is how I can fuel my body to feel its best, So nutrition is very all-encompassing. There's so many fields in nutrition, which is super nice. You can kind of expand into any one field that you might be interested in, whether it's oncology, sports nutrition, whatever it may be. There's something for everybody in this field.
Yeah, and I think too that fuel the body to be an athlete, because obviously this podcast isn't like be your most shredded self, you know?
No,
Like
I'm
we're
not
just trying to
accomplishing quite
survive,
yet.
you know? We don't want to die is what we're trying
No,
to do.
not
So,
yet.
but I think that same philosophy of fueling your body, because when you get into Nutcracker space, I lost a lot of muscle mass just because I couldn't work
Right.
out, but also I wasn't eating, I was loss of appetite, nausea. So talking about fueling your body for chronic illness is a very, very challenging one. I was super nauseous all the time, choking food down. Just to know, like literally having to be like, okay, one more bite, one more bite. And a lot of people listening to this can probably resonate with that. So before we kind of jump into that space, transitioning into food as fuel to help us navigate this extremely rare syndrome, vascular compression, I do want to talk about one thing. And I know that this is a very passionate thing in the registered dietitian space. I'm also passionate about it because I have a handful of registered dietitian friends. Talk to us about the difference between being a registered dietitian and a nutritionist and why you want to seek a registered dietitian and not just somebody who promotes themselves as a nutritionist.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. I equate being called a nutritionist to like if you pet a cat backwards. So that's kind of how we feel about it because it is so different. And really, it boils down to like the education piece of it. We go through a lot to become registered dietitians, and it's actually more strenuous now than it used to be. Because right now, you need a bachelor's degree and an advanced degree in nutrition, so a bachelor's and master's degree. Only then you qualify to apply for the rigorous dietetic internship, which is about 1,200 hours. Or a little around a year of unpaid work, basically, as a dietitian. You see, the unpaid bit is really kind of aggravating.
I
Some,
have opinions about that, but we'll get to
like
that later.
free labor, that sounds illegal,
Yeah.
almost. But, some of them have stipends, but most of them are unpaid. But you get experience in all sorts of different fields. Like I mentioned, you get to shadow oncology, nutrition, WIC, school nutrition. I got to shadow a sports dietitian, which was super cool. But you get to see all sorts of different fields and you learn about that. When you're done with your internship, you sit down for a very difficult and rigorous RD exam. And so a lot of people, the pass rate on that has actually kind of decreased over time because it is very difficult. But once you pass that, only then you're able to be licensed in the state that you practice in, if your state requires licensure to provide medical nutrition therapy. So medical nutrition therapy versus kind of talking about nutrition generally speaking, that is very specific nutrition advice to help treat and manage chronic conditions. So, for example, me telling someone with chronic kidney disease, these are the specific nutrients and the quantities you need to feel better and to treat this specific lab. So you kind of get into very detailed aspects there. So the education piece is huge for registered dietitians. The title registered dietitian is protected. So not everyone can just wake up and be like, I feel like a dietitian today. I'm just going to tell people I'm registered dietitians. You can get in trouble for that. So the title protection is another big thing. And then nutritionists, not all of them are created equal. I do know nutritionists that I very much appreciate and love, but there is no formal training required to be a nutritionist at all. You could wake up one day and be like, I am a nutritionist today, and you're perfectly fine to do that. Some people choose to kind of get a little bit of nutrition education online or like certifications, but that does not mean that they're qualified to give nutrition advice and especially medical nutrition therapy. That part of it is not legal. They can give overarching advice. They can say, Eating more fruits can help your blood pressure, but that's about as far as it can go. So really, especially if you're managing conditions like nutcracker syndrome or having surgeries or any type of chronic condition that you need to speak with someone, you definitely want a registered dietitian in your corner because they are trained medical experts. Like I said, not all nutritionists are created equal. Some of them are really great, but you do want that education piece on your side. And really, you got to make sure you're watching out and looking for those credentials. And there are some red flags that you want to be aware of when you're seeing people online, influencers and whatnot, especially if people are making, very extreme claims about food groups, eliminating food groups, adding thing, raw milk, you don't want to do that. If they're selling supplements and just kind of demonizing certain things, those are some red flags to watch out for. So definitely look for those credentials.
Absolutely. And in a time of like the information be so readily available, especially on social media, you can find yourself on that rabbit hole like I find myself on, and all of a sudden you're on this nutritionist page. And because they are really charming and they know how to market themselves and stuff, it could come off that it is credible to you. So you
Probably.
start, taking it, and then you're actually causing more harm to your body. So I thought that was a really important thing for us to touch on from an education standpoint, for everybody, but especially this population of seeking out a registered dietitian. We'll get a little bit later in the show, like stay tuned, everybody, because we'll talk about like how to get connected with a registered dietitian. But I do want to let's jump in. Speaking of food, meat and potatoes, side of broccoli, get a little bit of
Yes.
veggies in there. On what I want to talk about today, and I thought maybe the best way to do this is to break this up into three separate parts. So, the first part, we'll talk about things people can do as they wait for surgery to mitigate the effects of nutcracker syndrome. Second part will be the nutrition for surgery itself while inpatient, which some of that can be really challenging because hospitals themselves, I can go into the specifics of that. That was not great. And then the last one is like nutrition once discharged from the hospital and beyond. So how to help your kidneys once you have either you relocated the kidney or you had a left renal vein transposition, whatever it might be. So essentially just the pre, during, and post-op chat around kidney health. So for starters, let's talk pre-operatively. Some of our audience is waiting for treatment, hoping for treatment, fingers crossed that they get it. What are things that people with nutcracker syndrome who are either waiting for even just a diagnosis and subsequent surgery, what should they consider in general when it comes to kidney health?
Yeah, and in general, you are kind of anticipating a surgery coming up, and so your body's going to go through it, right? So it is super important to think about optimizing your nutrition status, no matter where you are in that kind of stage. And doing research and just kind of hearing about your journey, Simone, a lot of people come into surgery with maybe some poor nutrition because of one, the GI symptoms, and two, the pain causing poor appetite. The last thing you want to do is have a full meal with all your nutrients when, you're just trying to survive the pain for that day. And so really working with a dietitian to assess where you are physically and looking at your lab results as well, you want to make sure that they are addressing any type of micronutrient deficiencies like B12 or iron or so forth, making sure that your body is ready in that aspect, but also making sure that any sort of weight loss is mitigated right away. Assessing for protein, calorie, malnutrition is within our scope of practice as well, because I didn't mention before, but dietitians can make nutrition-related diagnoses like malnutrition. So really what you want is to have them do a full assessment, like a nutrition-focused physical exam, kind of see if there's any muscle wasting, fat wasting, and so forth, so we can kind of address that right away to optimize your nutrition pre-surgery. You want the best outcomes after surgery, and making sure that you're going into it ready for surgery is going to be very optimal here.
Yeah, and I want to say too, I've talked about this in the kidney autotransplant initial consult episode. With Dr. Foley, I can really only speak to Dr. Foley at UW Health in Madison, Wisconsin. Other Nutcracker surgeons, like at UC Health, I don't know if they actually have a registered dietitian component, but I met with a registered dietitian because I had lost at that point up to 10 to 15 pounds. And they have their own algorithm to determine, and they want to make sure that you meet standards that you don't go in too frail into surgery
Yeah.
because it is a hefty surgery. So that's something to like one of the things I'm thinking if knowing what I know now, because I wasn't working with a registered dietitian throughout, I was really like didn't really know how to. I mean, I could have reached out to you, obviously. Looking back, I'm like, gosh, but you're so stressed with just getting the X's and O's of finding the surgeon, getting the diagnosis, that a registered dietitian feels very kind of like a side quest in a bit. But
Totally.
what I want to tell the audience is I want to encourage you to bring that registered dietitian centerfold into the rest of your medical group and let them be a vital part of it. Because if you are waiting on a diagnosis and treatment, for example, people have been turned away from a kidney auto transplant because they are too frail, or they're told, hey, leave, and maybe they're given vague instructions to drink some more protein shakes to up their weight. Go ahead now and set yourself up for success on getting a registered dietitian on board so that you can not only mitigate the effects of your chronic pain and from nutcracker progressing. Again, I'm not 100% sure the mechanisms there, but that when you get to that initial consult, you can communicate with that surgeon that I've already been working with a registered dietitian. Like that's going to be music to their ears because they want to see that you're doing everything you can. That was something I didn't do. And looking back, I'm like, gosh, that would have actually been very helpful on my journey, which is why I want to say this explicitly on this episode to encourage you all to seek out a registered dietitian, bring them into your medical team, not as like a little side quest. I wanted another follow-up. So a couple things you and I have talked about, Tracy, to help to get me to help you kind of see myself. I was not well, let me back up. My brain's getting ahead of myself. One of the things some vascular doctors, interventional radiologists, or nutcracker surgeons will tell patients, I never had somebody tell me this, but they might say, hey, first line of defense is for you to gain some weight. Because there's this fat pad that can go between the aorta and the superior mesenteric artery. So that fat pad, if we can expand that, basically make that spot a little bit chunkier than we can give. I don't know. It's funny to me to think about. If we can make that bigger, it will actually provide a padding for the left renal vein to alleviate the compression. Talk to us about that. So nutcracker patients are being told that they first need to try this gaining weight. The mechanism, again, like I told you, is to increase that fat pad. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I actually did come across that a few times when I was researching a little bit more about, nutrition intervention specifically for nutcracker syndrome. I thought that was quite fascinating. I think this is going to be very individualized to the person because, there certainly can be that advice could be very appropriate for someone that has come into this before surgery, unintentional weight loss, muscle mass loss, fat loss, whatever, because of poor appetite and GI symptoms related to the poor appetite. So weight gain could be perfectly appropriate in that stage. You kind of want to address the whole person though, right? Because everybody is different here. So you may. I definitely would recommend if you and your provider do deem that weight gain is appropriate for a variety of reasons, to work with a dietitian because weight gain, where it sounds like, oh, I could just eat a whole pizza or a cheesecake and I will gain weight like right away. I mean, yeah, probably, but there's a healthy way to do this so that you're meeting all of your needs, in the proportions that you need. I will say I would encourage people to discuss their options with their provider if you're unsure about this. Ask them questions, talk to them about the literature around this. How often do they see success with symptom management when it comes to weight gain? How often do we actually see weight gain happening in that area that we're trying to gain weight in, where I would love to be able to distribute body fat on my body in certain areas. You can't really tell your body where to do that. Not saying, it wouldn't work. I am certainly no expert on that, but I would just certainly talk to them about the literature and how often they kind of see results here. And if you're unsure about it, don't be afraid to get a second opinion or do your own research when it comes to that. How easy would it be to be like, all right, let's eat some pizza. Let's go right to the fat pad. Let's
That's
go.
what I'm saying. I'm like, yeah, I would love for my fad to go to my tits and my butt, but
That's
like
what I'm
the inner
screaming.
thighs, baby.
No, I would have done that a long time ago, alas.
Well, and I'm so glad you're talking about this because what I do want this podcast to do is to help people feel validated. So If you're out there and you, let's say you try that as the first line of defense, because I do think like leave no stone unturned, let's try that weight gain. But if it's truly not working for you and alleviating the symptoms, it's probably because the fat that you're putting on is going to the inner thigh and it's not going to that specific fat pad. You know what I'm saying? Like beauty standards, internal beauty standards. So it could be that, but so it's not to say, oh, throw that out with the bath water. It's to like, yes, try it. I think the least invasive ways that you can do it, let's give it a go. But if it's not working for you, it's not working for you. And it's because, like you said, we can't, there's not a computer where we can go in and do the algorithm and say send all my fat to that fat pad in between the superior mesenteric artery and the aorta. Like that'd be wild. I would love to live in a body where you could do that.
Totally.
So for you all out there, give it a shot. But again, like if you want your fat to go to your butt and your tits, you know, or that fat pad, but it's going to your butt and your tits, like that's just, there's not really much you can do. Yeah,
Ask the
so
questions.
yeah, ask the questions. I love that you said the literature. I have an episode, I think it's episode 3 or 4, on questions to ask doctors. And so a lot of doctors will throw out there, like, yeah, this surgery has an 85% success rate. Okay, Dr. Jones, tell me more. I think that's another thing. Like, tell me the literature about what it says about that fat pad. What is the success rate? What are the limitations of it? And this is one of them. We can't pick where that fat goes, and if it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work. So don't gaslight yourself to think, oh, I'm not doing enough, I'm not eating enough, I'm not gaining weight right. We have a major tendency to do that just in the medical space in general, but when you have such a rare syndrome that the medical community doesn't even really know about, it's even harder to do that. The second follow-up, go ahead, did you have something?
I was just gonna say, weight gain itself again could be like super appropriate here. Even if your doctor's like, there's no guarantee. Looking at the whole person, if you have lost weight, and especially if it was unintentional, unhealthy weight loss because of poor appetite and so forth, weight gain, even if it may not relieve those symptoms specifically in that area, it could be perfectly appropriate and get you ready from a nutrition standpoint for future surgery. So certainly don't be afraid of weight gain itself. But when it comes to those symptoms, you definitely just want to ask, because you don't want to go in expecting, a 180 turnaround on these symptoms because the doctor said it may work. Go into it with realistic expectations, but going into it with an idea of, I'm going to do this to better my health status and get my body optimized for surgery is a good way to go about that.
Yeah, and some things coming up for me a little like off scripty is I mean, we've chatted about this being a woman, and so I lost all this weight. And here this was before I was like outwardly going to people in public like I'm sick, you know? And they were just like, wow, you look so good.
Oh,
So I
gosh.
was getting this positive reinforcement from being my most malnourished self. You know, and it felt good, I'm not gonna lie. I was just like, yeah, my clothes are fitting better, I'm down a size. Like, so I have in working with my therapist, so really this intersectionality of a registered dietitian, mental health, nutcracker surgeon, like it's a multimodal team of realizing, because that, oh, this is really triggering my disordered eating behaviors that I had prior, that I had known was there. Or for some of you, maybe you're realizing that the like this nutcracker syndrome symptoms is bringing up, making you realize you have disordered eating behaviors, which is a dysfunctional relationship to food. And like you have this weird voice in the back of your head of like, I hate that I'm going through this, but kind of a weird positive is that I'm losing weight and I look better. And then society was inadvertently telling me I looked good. Thankfully, I'm dating somebody. Kyle was like, he told me after the surgery, he was like, you're starting to look very, you know, just very, very frail. And he's like, let's start eating some food. Like he very much was supporting. He didn't positively reinforce that for me. I've had exes that have. He's very much like, yo, I like a curvy woman. Like, let's go. And it's like, I love that. So I wanted to touch on that for the community, normalize it for you. It's something that I'm still currently dealing with. Another thing also is the gaining weight of the shift will be that maybe you start, it's again the disordered eating, but you start to become really scared of food because Nutcracker syndrome often does not live alone. I think I've spoken to you about it's co if you have one vascular compression, you have multiple. So for me, I had May-Thurner syndrome, compression of the left iliac vein, and Nutcracker compression of the left renal vein. And who knows, I might have another compression. Sometimes people will have another compression pop up a year later after surgery. It's just this domino effect. So nutrition, again, that fat pad trying to make that bigger, like kind of a little chunkier, spicier, curvier woman in there, if you want to say. That doesn't mean maybe it alleviates the left renal vein symptoms, but you start having other symptoms pop up that could be related to another vascular symptom. So the gaining weight to increase that fat pad is very specific to Nutcracker, but some people, unbeknownst to them, could have another vascular compression. So wanted to bring that, just so people can critically think about that intervention. It's so complex. Let's transition into the next. This was a question that was brought up. I posted in our Nutcracker Facebook page and said, hey, if you have any specific questions. And one came up that I'm so happy that was asked, which is that some people with Nutcracker, again, have multiple compressions, May-Thurner, Malls, S masses, which as I call it, superior mesenteric artery syndrome. So a handful of these individuals they might be on feeding tubes, because again, one symptom is loss of appetite, nausea, not being able to keep food down, they're vomiting, so leading to people losing weight to the point of even needing to be on a feeding tube. Maybe these people are already working with a registered dietitian, but let's speak to that. Can you walk us through that process and things to share from a registered dietitian standpoint?
So I have worked with several people, especially in the hospital setting, and have been the kind of go-to person on choosing a tube feeding for them and kind of working with them on that. So it definitely could be necessary, like you said, if the oral intake is not enough to meet your needs, but you're also having, inability to keep food down. That's one of the bigger reasons why people may need a tube feeding, because you got to get that nutrition in somehow, especially weight loss and protein calorie malnutrition, if that's coming into play as well. And again, we want to make sure that we're mitigating any type of, weight loss and poor nutrition because of post-op complications related to poor nutrition leading up to that. So it definitely can be necessary. It seems like a scary idea, for some people. I'm sure it can be very overwhelming to think, oh, I need a tube feeding. I got to have something feeding me. That's crazy. But it really, what I tell people is it's considered temporary support, unless there's some like extenuating circumstance that may become permanent. But in most cases, it's temporary support, making sure that you're optimized for that upcoming surgery. So the dietitian, most people will have a dietitian kind of in their corner already when it comes to this. So they will assess you as a whole, kind of figure out, if you have other comorbids that they need to be aware of to help you to choose a tube feeding formula. They'll choose one for you. They'll assess your height, weight, body composition, and so forth to figure out how much of that tube feeding you're going to need throughout the day. They typically will start off at a very slow rate, something like 30 mils per hour, if you're doing a 24-hour type of thing. They'll assess whether you're tolerating it. So if there's any worsening GI symptoms, vomiting, inappropriate bowel movements and so forth, we may cut that back or try a different formula and so forth. But if you're tolerating it well, we'll increase that rate slowly up to the goal rate, which is meeting, all of your needs, protein, calorie, and so forth as tolerated. And so throughout the whole process too, they're looking at your lab chemistry, how you're doing, if we're seeing some positive weight gain and some positive, side effects from this artificial feedings. And they're always going to monitor to see whether or not you're ready to for that to be tapered down and ready for oral intake as well. So they're constantly assessing this. They're constantly making sure that we are going to transition you back to oral intake whenever you are ready for it. Again, if you are nervous about this, definitely talk to your team. Make sure you do have a dietitian in your corner first off and see whether or not you've exhausted all of your options, right? Are you on appropriate medicines to help with these GI side effects? Could an appetite stimulant be appropriate here? We frequently see that that could be something, especially in the dialysis world. Poor appetite's very common. We may start people on appetite stimulants just to get them back to feeling hungry, after a long time of having poor appetite. your hunger fullness signals are kind of all jacked up, and you don't really know when you're feeling hungry or if you're just tired, you know, whatever it may be. But that may be something to consider as well. But again, don't be afraid of a tube feeding. Again, we consider it temporary support for the most part, and you do have a lot of good people in your corner and the dietitian, you know, making this personalized to your journey.
I'm like writing down notes for me. I have a GI. I'm about 3.5 months post-op from kidney endo transplant and feeling night and day better, but I'm loss of appetite, nausea is still a thing. And they said, you know, a lot of people with these vascular compressions have GI problems, but again, it's the trauma, it's the chronic pain. Like you just said, my brain has rewired itself almost to like learn that I'm not hungry. So I have a GI appointment coming up in May, and I'm like adding appetite. Like, I'm like, can we talk about like getting my appetite back? That's the biggest thing, is I almost have to like set an alarm to be like, you need to eat. So the one thing I think could be really beneficial for the audience, I get nervous just about the process of stuff. So we're talking about tube feeding. What is that? Is that like a tube in your nose? Like, what is that process like?
So there's different pathways to do this. A more permanent pathway, if someone, you know, needs a lot of help after surgery and so forth, they would get like a peg placed in their abdomen. That's where you can deliver a lot of those tube feeding formulas. But in a temporary space, it's an NG tube, nasogastric tube. There's an OG tube as well if we need to go down the throat, if there's something going on with your sinuses that doesn't prevent, that prevents us from using the NG tube. But it's a small tube that goes through your nose and down your throat and empties into the stomach. And so the doctor, or sometimes actually dietitians now within our scope in the hospital setting, can place these as well. But a lot of the time, your medical team will place that for you, and they'll kind of monitor to make sure it's placed correctly. I never did this, thought of that. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can do that to someone, you know, freaks me out a little bit, but it's super well practiced. You know, this is very, very common. I did so many tube feeding consults when I was in the hospital because it becomes necessary for a variety of reasons. You know, it's very common. Don't be nervous. I know it sounds like a crazy process, but it's not. It's super common. We want to make sure that you are getting your nutrition optimized and making sure that we're meeting your needs. I will say that if you find yourself in the hospital not able to keep things down, you're really struggling, especially if it's been a couple of days, you know, that could be something that gets brought up pretty quickly. We don't want people to go without for a while.
And I two things you mentioned. I loved that you said, you know, that obviously there's cases where this could be a permanent thing, but most likely it's very acute. That was something I really had to wrap my head around. And I speak about this with anti-anxiety meds. I realized I had a bias around. I mean, I'm a performance psych. I literally teach meditation and breathing and like ways to. And so I was using those things and almost shaming myself that I wasn't doing good enough. Like, I'm not meditating enough, you know, like I gotta be a more hardcore meditator. And then it was my primary that was like, hey, this is really stressful. What do you think about anti-anxiety meds? And I originally was like, no. And he was like, well, let's just do the GAD-7, the Generalized Anxiety Disorder 7 scale. And I came out as severe anxiety. And
You're
he
like,
was like,
oh.
yeah. And he told me about my options. And I finally said, you know what? Go ahead and prescribe this middle line non-addictive anti-anxiety. Because guess what? I can also not take it when I get home, or I can take it and stop. Like, you have agency, but go ahead and get the prescription just so that you have it if you do want to use it. And I think about the feeding tube that way of like, we're going through so much that if I was ever to have been on a feeding tube, I think that would have really, there's emotion there. There's grief of like, holy shit, I have to
I'm
be on a
here now.
feeding tube. Like, this is bad. You know, let yourself feel that and understand this is acute. This is to help me get, this is what my body needs. And it's about what can we do to be as kind and compassionate towards our body. And so maybe it is doing the anti-anxiety meds until the surgery. Maybe it is the feeding tube. I wanted to normalize that. Another thing too about the whole don't be nervous about the tube itself. I remember being so nervous about getting the stent removed that was going from my ureter into my bladder 3 weeks post-op, because you're awake for it. They don't do, I mean, they kind of numb you down there, but it didn't hurt at all. It was like the anxiety and the anticipation was the most painful part. I kind of, as you were saying that, I was like, oh, I feel like this is probably a similar situation of like you work yourself up for the tube itself, and it's the anticipation that's the more painful part of it.
Totally. And I think people have an idea in their head about what that means, right? Like, oh, I'm getting artificial feedings. Like, this is the end. Or, they have this image in their head of someone that's hooked up to all these wires and so forth. And, that's kind of what their life is. But I encourage you to ask your providers. I gave a very, very rough outline of what that could look like. But ask your providers about all of the steps involved in placing that tube feeding, selecting the formula, and so forth. And if you are in the hospital on a tube feeding, ask your dietitian like questions about the formula and what their plans are and how to move forward with that. We don't want people to be on that forever. If you can eat and if your gut is working, we want you to be able to eat. And so I really love what you said about it's honoring your body in the stage that it's in. Like, okay, this is where I am. This is maybe what's necessary, and that's okay because it doesn't have to be forever. This is just the stage that I'm in right now.
So if anybody is listening to this episode and you've done your tube feedings, drop some comments, normalize it, maybe be like, oh, it wasn't as bad, or if it the opposite, it was a little bit worse than I thought. This episode is just sparking a conversation. Use the comments to continue that so that it can help other people know it's what to expect. I can't speak to it specifically. I do think if I would have gone on longer, I probably would have been a tube feeder. I don't know if that's what you call them.
We can call it from now on.
You're a tube feeder now. Okay, I want to then transition, before we actually get into this kind of second stage, this inpatient, is there anything else preoperatively that you want to touch on, or you feel like we cinched that up?
I feel like we captured a lot of that again, making sure that you do have that dietitian on your team. But I also love what you said about having other providers on your team as well, because this is very taxing psychologically and emotionally. So making sure that you are having a therapist, social worker, whatever you might need, whatever's available to you in order to talk this through.
Me and Barbara, my therapist, were
Barbara.
BFFs. Yeah, shout out Barbara. She got me through so much. She would answer the call and I'd be like just crying. I'd be like, I don't even know what I'm crying about. She's like, this is so the you're so I was so overwhelmed. I had just such an onslaught of emotion that I felt numb, and that was really hard to carry. But I want to transition into that inpatient. So for those that just had your surgery, I mean, maybe some of them are listening to this episode while you're in that inpatient room. I loved my inpatient experience. And you're in a very vulnerable stage of healing. So when you're in the hospital, what are things patients should be like? This is where I'm thinking ordering off the menu in the hospital to help boost kidney health and healing.
So you've just undergone a huge process, going through that surgery. Don't beat yourself up if you're not feeling hungry right away still, because your body has gone through a trauma. But it's a major surgery. And so you do have a dietitian in your corner that's going to assess your individual needs, because not everybody has only, one thing that we're focusing on. There are some people that have like other comorbids that the dietitian needs to consider on top of the healing after the surgery. So they'll work with you to order the appropriate diet for you. I've definitely had times in the hospital where I've had someone that is on like three different diets at once, kidney diabetic, heart healthy, a combination. So they kind of make sure that it's personalized to your needs. But after any type of major surgery like that, protein is going to become a huge importance here. I don't know if they kind of explained that to you as well, Simone, after your surgery, but wound healing, you have this huge wound that you're having to try to heal as well. So protein becomes very important. And that could be animal or plant protein, just kind of depending on if you're following any one specific eating pattern or so forth. But eggs, tuna, chicken, legumes, tofu, lentils, all those things, as long as you're not having any other electrolyte imbalances that could contraindicate those type of foods, and your dietitian will work with you on that. They may consider oral nutrition supplements after surgery, as well as before surgery, leading up to, gaining weight and optimizing your nutrition and whatnot, but after surgery as well, just to make sure that we're meeting those protein needs. And that could be, depending on the person, it could be like Boost or Ensure or Jufan, whatever they have on formulary that you could incorporate as well. Monitoring the electrolyte and deficiencies continues to be important and will be important going forward. What I will say is that just having worked in the hospital setting and I've had plenty of consults come forward, like patient requesting to speak to dietitian. I'm like, oh, awesome. They want to learn about whatever. And it's really to complain about the eggs. If you are not jiving with the hospital food after surgery, let people know. Let your team know, like, hey, this is what I like, don't like. Your appetite and the palatability of food is super important with healing throughout this whole process, because your nutrition may not have been optimal beforehand. But let them know, let them know these are my preferences. This is how I'd like this to be handled, because it really matters. Hospital food is not always the best. I don't know if you can speak to any of that. But there were so many times where I'm like, I gotta talk to the dietitian about these powdered eggs. And I'm like, I have no control. But let's figure out what you do like. And so
Absolutely. Well, it's funny because I think people think like, oh, you're the registered dietitian, you deal with food, so can you cook my eggs differently? And you're like, I'm not the one actually in the back cooking. Okay. I think that's just so a little bit, if some of you all in the audience, maybe you thought that, like, I think this is a great conversation to just have so you can understand what a registered dietitian's actually doing. I was writing down some things as you were talking because some people who followed me on Instagram know that this was like the shot heard around my social media was that I was on a liquid diet for about 20, 48 to 48 to 72 hours post-operatively because they wouldn't, until I had my first bowel movement or I just farted everything out. They were like, you can't eat full meals. And I woke up being like, I want a cheeseburger. So that was really challenging because it was like bone broths. I was really trying to, channel my inner Tracy and being like, what should I have? Getting the electrolytes, the bone broths, sugar-free Jell-O was something else I would do. That was just really frustrating because I wanted full food, but again, trusting that, well, yeah, I also don't want to eat a cheeseburger because then that's just going to sit in my gut and cause if I'm not having a bowel movement. So keep that in mind. That was something I wasn't expecting. I wasn't expecting that I would only be on a liquid diet for a little while. So there's that. I also, something that was really interesting for me, I was very, not an active pescatarian, but a lot of my diet prior and when I was healthy was very fish driven. So, salmon toast in the mornings with avocado and tomato and egg and stuff like that. And so when I finally was able to graduate from liquid diet to full diet, they had like a salmon dish with broccoli and stuff. And I was like, okay, that's what I'm going for. Some good omega-3s, some good protein. And it came out and it was like the smell so nauseating. And I was like, oh, this is just an acute thing. I still have not got my taste back for fish. It like and I've learned, I used to hear these myths of like transplant patients getting somebody else's kidney or liver or whatever, and that DNA changing your taste buds or your preferences.
I've heard that
And
too,
it, yeah, and I actually think I was talking to the nurses about it. It's more of an anesthesia thing that when you're under anesthesia for a long amount of time, it can that has effects on your body that they still aren't 100% sure why and how. Cilantro, I used to love cilantro. It tastes like soap to me now, and that's
gosh,
such a sad, sad,
unfortunate.
yeah, development, but we're still hopeful. So understand that maybe your preferences that you have, like you're speaking to your registered dietitian and saying, I would like to have the salmon dish or whatever. And then if it comes and you're just red onions was another thing. I would get Greek salads with red onions, and the red onions would just make me want to throw up. I used to love red onions. So be aware that those preferences, what you thought you might want, just honor your body. If it makes you nauseous, order something else. They have like a long list of things you can have, and what's crazy to me is they'll have like fried options on there, and I'm like, why is this even an option? That's like the last thing you need to be having, but is what I'm thinking, like a taco, a quesadilla with a bunch of cheese. I'm sure there's some aspects of it that maybe you can get from it, but it just feels so you do need to know your body, know what it needs. Protein was really big. The last episode I just published on hormones, I started testosterone supplements as well. So that helped me with healing. So I was like heavy on the protein, had my testosterone going. And that, I remember when they came in to kept checking my incision, they were like, wow, this is like,
It's
double time speed. Like,
like
whoa, oh my gosh. But talking about the lab work, I wanted to make this one last point. It was interesting because they come in every morning at like 5:30 a.m. and wake you up to do labs. And a few days post-op, they would bring in like a little packet of like magnesium that I'd have to drink. Or because, so that kind of speaking to like they're looking at your that profile and they might be like, oh, you're on the lower side of X, Y, and Z, so we're going to give you this to supplement. I almost hated that I didn't have that daily check-in once I was discharged, because like I almost was just like, oh, that'd be so nice if they could bring a phlebotomist to your discharge, you know, wherever you're renting or your home, and then they can look to see like, do I need, because I was like, how else do I know? Do I need magnesium today? So that's, I saw how intimately like a registered dietitian that nutrition is, and I wish I would have centered it more and actually had established a relationship with a registered dietitian going in. I could have had my check-ins, could have talked about things to just make me feel like it wasn't as much on me to have to make the decisions, but it was somebody helping me. Because it's, you're so drugged up, first of all, when you're inpatient, you don't know which way is up. I had, you know, Dilaudid was really starting to get to me. I was hallucinating from time to time. It was kind of fun, actually. I had some fun hallucinations.
Like,
So,
is it a live cheeseburger that's floating
yeah,
across my vision
exactly. I
lens?
was like, oh, this lion's coming straight at me, but I'm at peace. And now I feel like a goddess. I don't know. It was fun. So anything else you want to add for kind of that inpatient stuff?
I love the point that you made about preferences changing because, I'll just remind y'all to stay patient with yourself because it really could be that it takes time to kind of build back to where that you're eating what you want to eat and you're eating the amount that you want to eat and so forth. But again, don't be afraid to ask them. If the salmon dish is not jiving with you, even though you thought it would, tell them, don't be afraid to be annoying or whatever it is. You're not. You got to meet your needs. And sometimes that does mean ordering the fried food. It certainly has its place, right? Like we have those for a reason because sometimes, you're not going to like the renal diet, whatever prescription that they put you on, but you need to eat something. Talk to your dietitian and just say, hey, like this, I'm really feeling this. I'm hungry. Is this okay? Or, it's there for a reason. All food serves its purpose. And sometimes that is both nourishing the body and nourishing the soul. I'm sure that cheeseburger just hit just right when you were able to get it. And that is
Yeah.
highly powerful and super important. Food
It
is.
was when I got, it was a double patted double cheeseburger from oh my gosh, why am I blanking on the name of the place, and a large fry and a large Oreo milkshake. And Kyle has never seen me eat something so fast. I just, and I could feel my body eating it. Like it was like just like a nom, 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 like where the fuck has this been? And I remember it was from Culver's, that's where it was. The buttered bun. Oh my God. It was just, I couldn't.
Custard.
Yeah, so I love that you say that of like it's not, let's not demonize those, because some, I remember telling Kyle being like, I simply just need to eat something. And I, to be quite frank, I was getting bored and like losing my interest in other stuff, so I needed to mix it up.
Yeah, that's
So
super important.
normalizing that, yeah, normalizing the cheeseburger, normalizing the quesadilla, the tacos, like sometimes it is just about calories, and your body needing it for healing.
There's no bad food. The only bad food I tell people to avoid is food you're allergic to or food that's rotting.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. You see mold on
Everything
it,
has
don't
its
pop.
purpose.
Yeah, you see mold on that blueberry, don't pop it in your mouth.
Don't
Yeah.
pop it in there. I mean, you could, I guess no one's gonna stop you, but you may regret it.
Yeah.
You don't wanna, you'll learn from
Yeah,
it,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
but
Absolutely. Well, let's transition then into the post-op. So once you're discharged from the hospital, what are things that people should prepare to have at home? Something I spoke about in like the episode on how to support somebody with Nutcracker syndrome, something that was very, very helpful for me was having either meals prepped, or sometimes even just people sending money for us to order out, like takeout. What are some of those like meals that would be good to prep, to help with kidney function, just healing for the next 3 to 6 months and beyond?
So this is going to be a really important step here. The first recommendation I would make, as you mentioned, it would be so nice to have a phlebotomist to kind of tell me what my levels are. You'll definitely want to have a nephrologist in your corner. I'm assuming that that is pretty standard because they're going to want to check your kidney function and so forth. But they'll be drawing labs and electrolytes, and so that can help the dietitian. That can help guide the dietitian on specific recommendations. You need to eat more of this, less of this, a moderate amount of this, and so forth. So, getting those checked regularly will help drive the nutrition side of things. When you're 3 to 6 months post-op, it seems like you're kind of past the critical stage where you're past the liquid diet and so forth. And really now it's about mitigating any weight loss and maintaining adequate energy intake and muscle mass, especially. And so, like energy balance and muscle mass in general. So the dietitian will base make recommendations based on your current body chemistry, height, weight, so forth. This is how much you need every day. This is how many grams of protein that you need every day. And this is kind of how we can split that up. So in terms of having types of food on hand, I'm a huge supporter of having easy meals that you can grab. And so maybe that means that you're meal prepping on a Sunday or having your partner meal prep on a Sunday helping you out there. That could be things like making breakfast burritos one day and having a bunch of breakfast burritos with like eggs, veggies, sausage, whatever you want frozen and ready to go that you can warm up in the morning so you don't have to think about. Or oatmeal, overnight oatmeal. That's some people love that, some people don't like that, but I like having that on hand just because you can prep a few meals at once, grab it and go, or it's already ready for you so that you're not having to think about, what do I need? It could be, we love carbohydrates in this household. You know this. I distinctly remember you and I eating straight out of the cereal box one night. Like we were just loving
Oh
that.
God, yes.
But pastas, that could be a really great meal that you prep. It could be chickpea pasta if you want to increase your protein and fiber, paired with like veggies, marinara sauce, and like chicken sausage. You can make that in bulk and you can have that on hand ready to grab. Or it could be tuna salads, chicken salads, egg salads, things that are easy. And again, we're going to make sure that we're meeting our protein needs as well. But I am also not opposed, and this is kind of something that I do, having easy things on hand that you'd really don't have to prep, but you can just grab. And so sometimes that's a protein shake or sometimes that's a protein bar, things that are convenient. You may not always feel like eating lunch, let's say, or breakfast, or you get into a habit of not eating regularly throughout the day. And grabbing something like that is going to be better than not having anything at all. You want to make sure you're fueling your body and honoring your body throughout the day. And so those are just some examples of things that I like to do, keep on hand, but your dietitian would be able to give you more specific recommendations if you need to manipulate any electrolytes, but also recipes.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was working, I just met with a registered dietitian once at UW Health. They determined that I was good to go. I had good grip strength and stuff like that. So I didn't see her beyond that, but I did ask. I was like, "Oh, do you? I'm assuming you have like a pamphlet or a printout of something of like snack ideas, like just kind of help me." So I did get that. So anytime you do see somebody like asking for that, just so you have it on hand to spark. We're dealing with brain fog, massive fatigue. So sometimes it's not just a matter of like the act of meal prepping is exhausting in and of itself, but even just Kyle sometimes will be like, he'll be like, "What do you want for dinner?" I'm like, "I do not have the mental capacity. I have no idea." Like, I'm just so having that handout where it's the registered dietitian helping you make the decision, and then you're just going to the grocery store or having somebody go for you to pick those things up. I really post-operatively, we went to this down in Buena Vista, Colorado, this breakfast place, and I ordered the only thing that seemed kind of appetizing to me. It was this coconut milk quinoa porridge, and it had blueberries. Yeah, dude, it had these blueberries and bananas and pumpkin seeds in it. And I remember taking the first bite, I was like, "Wow, this is pretty good." And I was like, "I can make this at home." So that's the main thing that I've been eating, the quinoa having good plant protein in it, the coconut milk having some fat in there for you. I cut that with some water as well. The blueberries having some good antioxidants. So I also want, I know I didn't really prep you for this, but I try to be conscious of, I am a meat eater. I'm getting slower, more and more away from it. So, but some of my protein is coming from chicken. For those people though, that are, I know you just made a post on your dietitian page, which is what this is making me think. I want to honor those that are listening to this audience of plant proteins and how to get protein intake there. And if some people might be nervous that I don't know if I'll get enough, maybe I need to break out and start eating meat. If you can talk about that a little bit as well.
Yeah, so there is more and more research coming out on the protective nature of a plant-based diet. And this is not to say that meat doesn't have its place for some people, because it certainly does, right? Especially if certain things are not appetizing, we want to make sure that we're incorporating and not over-restricting ourselves. But we do see in the kidney space, especially, the power of plant protein versus animal protein. And this may not be, in the space that everybody listening to this is in, but it's just an example. So if you have chronic kidney disease, for example, there's a lot of really positive research on the effects of incorporating plant-based protein instead of meats, because it's just more protective of the kidneys, a little bit gentler on the kidneys, and it has all sorts of other micronutrients, dietary fiber, anti-inflammatory properties that may be able to protect kidney function for a longer time. And so there, a lot of people are afraid that they're not going to meet their protein needs with a plant-based diet or even just incorporating more plants. But work with your dietitian on this, because you certainly can. It could look very different for people. And I can give some examples. Tofu, chickpeas, lentils, quinoa is a really great source of protein, edamame. There's all sorts of variety that you can incorporate. But we find that to be super beneficial, even outside the kidney space. We see improvements in blood pressure, improvements in inflammatory conditions, and so forth. 90% of Americans don't get enough dietary fiber. We get a lot of fiber benefit as well as protein when it comes to making certain choices like these. And so you can meet your needs, and it can be very beneficial. And again, it's not to demonize any other pattern of eating. It's just to say this is something to consider adding to your diet.
And I would, as you're talking, I'm like, gosh, this is probably intersected by so much complexity. Meaning, like, if you are eating meat, where is that meat coming from? Has it been pumped with hormones? Has it not? I mean, there's that. Like, when you brought up soybeans, for example, like the episode I just did on hormones, is that there's so much we don't know about the vascular compression space in the first place. I intuitively feel that my own working theory is my hormones started tanking the same time my vascular symptoms started to show. I don't know, it's a chicken or the egg. I don't know if the vascular system started making my hormones tank or the hormones tanked and then led to the vascular compressions. But then if you're thinking about like having soybean, for example, like that in of itself could influence kind of estrogen receptors, that endometriosis if you have. So there's it, when it comes to diet, working with a registered dietitian that knows your medical history, right? Like, oh, you have endometriosis and that's an estrogen fueled inflammatory response. Okay, well let's educate you and talk about foods to eat that aren't going to provoke that. So it's not just about I bring up this intersected complexity to you all as an audience because it's not just about like, oh, Tracy on the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast said to add, edamame, X, Y, tofu, and quinoa, but it's about specifically speaking to a registered dietitian on are those specific plant foods good for you based on the diagnoses that you already have? Because most people in the vascular compression space, I've never met one person that's like, I was completely healthy, no other diagnoses, and I just had this one random vascular compression pop up. We have people that have it's comorbid with EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, people that have been diagnosed with POTS, although I think POTS is just a residual effect of the vascular symptoms, but likely not. Again, we don't know that that's a direct strong effect size there. They endometriosis is another thing. There's a lot of gynecology issues, adenomyosis. That's why it's so important. So please don't take this as similar to like social media. Well, Tracy said do X, Y, and Z. The entire purpose of this podcast is seek out a registered dietitian that knows your specific case and can really help you come with a detailed plan. Do you have anything else you wanted to add on that kind of post-op space?
Yeah, so just to kind of piggyback off of that, again, individual dietary advice needs to be given by your dietitian, but the registered dietitian is also trained to look at the whole person and not just in the medical space. There are a lot of nuances that exist that may prevent someone from having a good appetite or having the selection of food choices that they'd like to, food security issues, all sorts of different things, all sorts of different considerations that maybe your provider doesn't have in mind. And so working with them, so that you can get individually tailored advice, not only to your medical condition, but maybe to your social situation as well. Affordability of food is a huge topic right now. And so sometimes we're limited to just, what the food bank has. And that's okay, but tell your dietitian, like, hey, this is what I've got going on. What are some affordable options for me?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, just for like really showing the intersection of demographics, right? Like, what can you afford? Inflation is wild right now. Where are you at? It's making sure you advocate. The biggest thing I try to encourage is advocating, like telling your doctor, I have medical anxiety, so that they can help you through that. Maybe prescribe that one dose anti-anxiety med for a particular procedure or scan. Speaking to them about your socioeconomic status, and I can't shop at natural grocers, like I can't shop organic, right? Or whatever it is, there are options for you. And some of the stress and overwhelm is, I would like to eat healthy, but I can't, and a registered dietitian can actually help you see that there are options and alleviate that stress. I just, as you're talking, I'm like, if nobody else gets anything out of this, I'm getting so much
I'm so
selfishly. Like,
glad.
I'm just doing this for me, nobody else. Just kidding,
We don't
just
even have
kidding.
to publish this if you don't
We're
want
not, not,
to.
yeah. I'll
Sorry.
be like, this episode's for me. Y'all are welcome to listen, but whatever. That's why I'm a professor. I'm just selfishly learning, and like maybe people are learning from what I teach. I want to transition into some, like, just concluding the episode out. So people are listening to this and they're like, done, sold. I want to go find a registered dietitian. I know you sent me some websites that I will, eatright.org is one, as well as healthprofs.com. I will be putting those in the show notes, but speak specifically toward people finding a credible registered dietitian and then filtering for the specific needs, like kidney health or vascular compression. Also insurance, like kind of talking about that. How can people find that?
Yeah, so the two that you mentioned, the eatright.org and the health props, are some directories that you can use to search for registered dietitian in your area, but it should also allow you to filter for a specific specialty. If you're looking for a kidney dietitian or eating disorder specialized dietitian or oncology, so forth, you can filter that way to specialty. I believe you can filter on both of those directories, health props and eatright. Dot org, you can filter to see whether or not they take insurance. In this market, we try to take insurance if we can. Another option is to contact your insurance company. You can call them or look on their website to see if you have any dietitians in your area that are in network, and you may be able to contact them and kind of see what type of services they offer that are covered for you. Another thing that I did want to mention, you can ask your insurance company, or if you're established with a dietitian that's in private practice or something like that, ask them if, one, they have flexible payment options if you're speaking with your dietitian. But two, ask both the insurance and the registered dietitian if HSA, the health savings account, is something that you can use to pay for your services. I know that some dietitians in private practice have the ability to take HSA, and so that should alleviate a little bit of that burden. Talk to your interdisciplinary team, so your healthcare team, about if they know registered dietitians in the area and see if they can give you a referral. They may know someone personally and have good things to say about that person, so that could be a really good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to highlight, I think it's like episode 3 where I say like what questions to ask your doctors, and it's I don't necessarily go into the specific questions, but two that I say is like vet your, if you have the privilege, because this is intersected by the type of insurance you have, your socioeconomic status, where you are regionally as well. Like maybe you don't have a lot of options. Telehealth could be a good option for you. But ask, don't forget that the registered dietitian, like you're vetting them to be on your medical team. So like, what are their advocacy efforts like for the patient? Like, let's say maybe they don't know about vascular compressions. What will they do to help educate themselves to better serve you? Like, don't be scared to ask that question, because how they answer is going to tell you exactly how they're going to work for you. And then also, what is their interdisciplinary approach like? Like, those same questions I offered in that episode, also remember to vet the registered dietitian. If you have a couple that are in network, set up some consults with all of them and see who you like the most and you jive with the most.
Yeah, I was going to highlight the importance of that. But just like any medical team member that you meet and maybe you just don't jive with very well, that can happen in the registered dietitian space too. And that's okay. You know, sometimes people mesh well, sometimes people don't. Sometimes there's an approach that works for you and sometimes there's not. You know, so it is okay to shop around. A lot of dietitians that are in the private practice space as well will offer discovery calls. So that could be like a free 10 to 15 minute call that you can, get on with them and you can kind of figure out, okay, what is your approach? How are we going to work together? Are we going to work well together? So that could be a really good thing to look into.
This also led me to another question. What are some red flags that they should look out for when vetting a registered dietitian?
Yeah, so for me, I feel that if you have a dietitian that has an all or nothing approach and really doesn't want to meet you in the middle, I think that could be a red flag. You know, I'm giving you this meal plan and this is the only thing that you're allowed to eat. I would hope that none of us would do that, but you never know. You know, you want to make sure that the dietitian is able to meet you where you're at, socioeconomically, medically, emotionally, as well, and is able to kind of work with you and not throw just a sheet of paper at you and say good luck. You know, we want to have a team member and someone that's in our corner. So I would just say making sure that you work well with the dietitian and they're able to meet you where you're at. That's going to be a huge thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the things when I've worked with a registered dietitian before is I out the gate will at again always advocate for self, like be vulnerable to say, like I will say I have a disordered eating relationship. Like my relationship with food has not been the healthiest across, you know, some in some contexts of life it's good and others it's not. So I let them know that up front so that they're just aware of helping me navigate that and they're not inadvertently using even a language that could trigger me because they don't know. Another thing too is talking about just my medical anxiety, asking about their interdisciplinary approach, how they advocate. But yeah, that all or nothing, very black or white fixed mindset.
My way or the highway. Yeah.
Yeah, my way or the highway or like the should to, have to, ought to language, like you
Yeah.
should be doing this, you shouldn't have done that. Like, that's also something from a psychology perspective I talk to students about, of like, let's get out of this very fixed shaming space and really just like you said, sometimes it is the fried food and it is the Culver's double cheeseburger with extra large
Feeling.
milkshake that you need, and to have a dietitian that's like sending you those clapping hand emojis, being like, hell yeah, that's what you
So
want.
proud of you. You
Yeah,
know, like that's great.
you guzzle that freaking cheeseburger, you know? Like, so I'm glad we kind of spoke. It hit me. I was like, oh, let's let people, especially if people are new to this space, what could be red flags? So think about that, you all that are listening. I want to transition too into how can people get in contact with you? Like your speak toward, I know we've talked about like you're licensed in Tennessee, but you kind of spoke a little bit about that RD space. If people are like, oh, I really, what Tracy's talked about, I really jive. I want to reach out and see if I can work with her. Who can you work with? Is insurance involved in what you do? Just give a little blurb there.
Yeah, so at the moment I don't take insurance, so it's just private pay. But if you are interested in working with me, I do offer the flexible payment options as well, so we can kind of work with you on that. But I do have an Instagram page; it's rep.nutrition, and then my Facebook page is also rep.nutrition. Email address is repnutrition@gmail.com. You can see there's a little bit of a trend there. But I am licensed in the state of Tennessee, but I do provide all of my work is done remotely, so via telehealth. There is a lot of legislature coming down the pipeline on dietitian licensing and so forth. And so that should allow us to be able to practice in other states that are part of this agreement. It's called the licensure. Why can't I say that word? I didn't know this about myself. Compact. And so participating states, you know, if Tennessee is one of them, and I think there's eight other states, so they've agreed to this. I'm going to avoid that word like the plague. They've agreed to this, so licensure. You should be able to work with a dietitian, or a dietitian is able to practice in those participating states. But there are also certain states that have different laws and regulations when it comes to nutrition services being provided in those states. So there are a few. California, Colorado, Virginia, and Arizona, I believe that I would be able to see folks via telehealth and provide nutrition services that way. So, when in doubt, if you don't live in Tennessee, you can feel free to reach out to me and I will do some research on that specific state's licensure laws and so forth, and we can come up with a plan to be able to work together.
Oh, I love that. I'll make sure in the show notes. So just for you all as the audience to know, I'm going to put the websites in there on finding an accredited registered dietitian, the eatright.org, the healthprops.com. Then I'll put your information in there, your Instagram page, just if you all want to, I encourage you all to follow Tracy. She's constantly putting stuff up just on like kidney health and things. You can engage with her there. I'll put your email obviously up. So if people want to reach out, and go from there. Are there other, like, kind of concluding the last final question I have, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't discussed?
I think really the bottom line of this episode, I always come back to self-advocacy. I know that you can speak to a lot of this, Simone, just with your journey, but it's super sad how much we have to advocate for ourselves in the medical space, but it is super necessary. We know our bodies, we know what we're going through, and sometimes it can be super frustrating when we feel that the medical team is not listening. You're like, no, I'm still having these symptoms. I promise it's not anxiety. There's something else going on. That kind of thing drives me nuts. And I won't go too in depth with this, but what drives me nuts also in the medical world is weight bias. I'm coming to you. I have a, there's pain in my ear. Don't tell me to lose weight. I need you to fix this ear infection. You know what I mean? Like, or my tooth hurts. I'm at the dentist. You need to lose weight. No, I'm here at the dentist. Why are you telling me to lose weight?
Stop telling me my tooth is fat. Stop,
Yeah, literally, like
I ain't
so,
got a chubby tooth.
right. And so self-efficacy here. You all need to listen to me. This is the symptom. These are the symptoms that I'm feeling. Getting second opinions, asking questions. And what I'll also say is if you have family members that are undergoing, medical issues and you feel that they're maybe not the best advocates for themselves or they are too afraid to ask questions, ask them if they want company at their appointments. Ask all the questions. Like, I think that's super huge. That's something that I'll do with my grandparents, and my mom will do that with the grandparents because they'll sit there and be like, okay, this is what the doctor says. And if you're like, okay, tell me why they said that, they're like, well, I don't know. So it's really nice to have someone there in your corner that will help you ask the questions, because especially in the case of nutcracker syndrome, you have so much pain. You're thinking about this pain. Brain fog is super real. You may not have the capacity to or the energy to ask all the questions that are floating around in your brain. So having someone there as a support person can be super beneficial. In terms of dietitian, kidney world, all the things, again, I may be biased, but I always tell people try to get a dietitian in your team. Even if you don't have a chronic condition that you're facing or anything that's upcoming and major that you need, immediate nutrition help. Just having someone there that can answer some of these questions and guide you on what's misinformation, what's science re based, and so forth, that can really be beneficial to you. And again, you are important. What you're going through matters, and don't be afraid to be like, look, this answer is not, sufficient enough for me. I'm going to get a second opinion.
Something when you were chatting that I thought I posted this on my story that you've probably seen, but some of the first signs of things declining for me is my GFR numbers, my filtration rate. When I would go to the ER, it was just dropping and dropping and dropping. And I think the lowest it got was 72. And kidney, if I remember that, it's like, is it 60 or 65 is when you start getting into kidney disease.
Yeah, there is like a little graph that you can look up that determines what quote unquote stage of kidney disease in you are in based on your GFR and also your creatinine numbers. But there is a scale from CKD stage one up to CKD stage five, and it kind of depends on what those GFR numbers are. And so that's a huge thing. I will say, if you have a primary care physician and you're getting your labs drawn and you notice some of your kidney numbers are whack, ask them for a referral for a nephrologist and a dietitian. No matter what stage, if they say, oh, it's super early on, you don't need a nephrologist, get one.
Exactly. And
Deadline.
that's what's annoying to me is nobody, it was me actually looking at my graphs because I go to the same ER so they can show you like in February of 24 and June of 24 and like, and all of a sudden I was like, wow, my GFR. And when I looked up what the GFR was, because nobody spoke to me about it, they would just be like, your kidneys look fine, because I wasn't, they weren't going to say, it's like they were gonna just say it's fine, it's fine, and fine until my kidney was exploding. You know, like that's what it felt like. Instead of saying, hey, I just wanna gently say, I'm noticing there's a downward trend, let's intervene here. That's why you have to be your biggest advocate, because nobody's really gonna say wee woo, alert, alert, until you are in the kidney disease. So I got down to the lowest was 72. So I was in kind of the, some of the graphs will say that's like early kidney disease. Like that's kind of showing you that something's wrong. Nobody said anything to me. No ER doc, no primary care, until I was like, holy shit. And the only thing, and it's a little bit of a side quest, the only doctor in my medical group was my acupuncturist, who I brought those numbers, and she said, let's do a kidney, like a an herb blend, like a little concoction. And that actually, doing that helped mitigate the effects and actually helped bump my numbers up to when I got to surgery. I got to surgery, I stopped taking the acupuncture herb supplements that I was doing, and now my GFR numbers are, it's like 110, 111. They're
That's what it
green,
should be.
green, green. Yeah. So that is another reason why having a registered dietitian is they can look at those numbers, speak to you about the trend that you're in. Another thing, I wasn't expecting to talk about this, but man, there's some good juicy things coming up. The creatinine numbers. I've had friends who will do a 24-hour urine analysis on the journey to getting diagnosed or waiting for treatment, and their creatinine is through the roof. So what do y'all see as registered dietitian? What are those numbers that maybe if an audience is listening to this, go pull up your labs yourself and not necessarily self-diagnose, but maybe you
Yeah,
could
don't do
say,
that.
yeah, but again, like how I went and was like, holy shit, I see, I clicked on the thing that said view graph details, like all your data across the year, and I was like, oh, this downward trend on this line graph doesn't look good. So I didn't self-diagnose myself as, oh, I'm early stage kidney disease. I just knew I need to explicitly seek this out. So what are some of the creatinine, maybe let's chat ratios, not necessarily numbers. Like if they have a high creatinine that's over, is that like a sign that you need a registered dietitian, or is it low creatinine?
I love that you brought that up because when you're looking at your own numbers, you definitely do as I say, don't do as I do. But I'm a Googler. If I'm looking at my
Yep.
numbers, I'm just like, what does this mean? Am I dying? Don't do
Same.
that. Just use
Samesies.
that. Yeah, I got a little anxiety seeing a therapist as well for
We
it
all do.
anyway.
I'm telling you right now, every single audience member listening to this, I know you do it. Don't sit there and say you don't. I know y'all have used ChatGPT to try to figure out, do I have cancer?
Literally. And
Yeah.
my anxiety is like, I got notes, and I got notes about like, tell me about yourself. Why do I have notes about myself? I know how to talk about myself. But anyways, so use that as a point of guiding in a conversation, look at those numbers and say, hey, what does this mean? Tell me about what this could mean. In the kidney space, we can see abnormalities in a couple of lab results. That's creatinine, BUN, and GFR. In the setting of dialysis, we don't typically look at GFR because they're already on dialysis. But creatinine and BUN are lab results that kind of tell us a little bit about waste products that are not being eliminated in the urine. And so if we see those levels are high, that could potentially mean that the kidneys aren't filtering like they should be. There are other causes for elevated creatinine, especially or just kind of wacky kidney numbers that may it may not mean that you have anything wrong with your kidneys. It could mean there's some dehydration, that's needing to be addressed. So without speaking to specific numbers, if you see any sort of red or trending up in your lab results, use that as a space to discuss that with your PCP or your nephrologist. But if you are seeing that your kidney numbers are kind of they're not changing. They're a little bit elevated all the time. Ask your PCP for a nephrology referral. It doesn't matter how above or below, but advocate for yourself in that space. And then what I'll say too, in the nephrology world, we tend to see, not all the time, but sometimes where people have a nephrologist they're seeing for like early stage two, stage three kidney disease, whatever it might be. And the nephrologist is like, oh, you don't really need a dietitian till later on. Get a dietitian. You can do so much for those early stages of kidney disease or kidney abnormalities with diet that may prevent, further deterioration of your kidney function. It's very nuanced. There's a lot of reasons why your labs might be a little bit wacky, so you definitely want to talk to your doctor about that. But again, having that dietitian referral is going to be very important if you're seeing consistently abnormal levels, for sure.
Yeah, my primary, our relationship is that he heard of Nutcracker syndrome once, never had a patient in his entire tenure of being a doctor. So I walk in there and I say, "Hey, I saw that my kidney numbers are like decreasing." And I'm just like, "Can you send me a referral to this?" And he's just always like, yes. If you have a doctor that's fighting you on it, being like, "I don't really think you need it," go find another doctor first and foremost, or sit there and fight with and be like, "No, I'm not, this isn't, send it in." Like,
This is not a request.
I'm not waiting until I get in the red and then I'm fighting for my life. Like a friend of mine, her creatinine numbers were really high, and the nephrologist she was working with was like, "I've never really seen this before. I don't really know why," and just left it at that. There was no like, "I'm good." That's why the question of what's your interdisciplinary approach like? Like if you come into a case like mine, because I'm not a regular horse, I'm a unicorn, I'm a zebra, right? Like I need you to treat me as such. And I'm not asking for preferential treatment, but I'm asking that you understand that I'm already at a deficit when it mean as a patient. I'm not like most cases. So I need to know that you're going to think outside the box, that you're going to think interdisciplinary. I'm
Individualized.
glad. Yeah, looking back, I'm like, oh gosh, I should have, again, with that should it to, I have to, ought to. So I want to be compassionate with myself, like bringing this conversation up a little further in the podcast to speak about labs, but I'll make sure to put it in the notes to say, hey, listen to the end, because that, like, here's another way you can advocate for yourself to go in and say, I don't like this downward trend or I don't like this upward trend. Can you please get me connected with somebody so I could just intervene, get ahead of the game? Tracy, thank you so much. This has
Thank
been
you.
selfishly amazing. I think that this is needed in our community to just start the conversation. Maybe yourself, you can share this with other registered dietitians to be like, hey, you could come across a Nutcracker syndrome patient. You could come across people with vascular compressions. We actually need to. This is a larger global advocacy, which is why I'm doing this podcast of we need to get this out there, not just to the patients on how to advocate for themselves, but the medical system needs to know about this. This is a real thing. I'm a living, walking example that an auto transplant changed my absolute life. I was a shell of a woman, a walking dead person, to now finally having some semblance of my life back. And it's wild to know that the majority of the medical community doesn't know about it. So thanks for kind of spearheading this into this space. I will, get this out there for them and just thank you. I just can't keep saying thank you enough. I feel this conversation makes me feel very supported that, oh, there's more people out there that care about us.
That care about the whole person. And I
Yeah.
appreciate you thinking of me and having me on. And I'm definitely going to practice saying the word licensure over and over again in the mirror after this. So,
Dude, same. I'll be like,
and we can, the
licensure.
show notes, we can do a pronunciation walk.
Yeah, and for anybody else having a problem saying this, or that's like what you get punished with. You have to say it like 10 times fast, licensure,
Yes.
licensure, licensure, licensure.
I'm
Oh
gonna be
gosh.
dreaming about
Oh, that's
that.
gonna be great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Tracy. And you're the best.
Thank you all.